Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining us on this edition of our English feature program. Coming up in just a moment, the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith asks bishops' conferences around the world to draw up guidelines dealing with sex abuse by clergy. The bishops of England and Wales call on Catholics in Britain to stop eating meat on Fridays. And Father Jim Brand focuses on prayer, picking up the theme introduced by Pope Benedict at the beginning of this month during his weekly general audience. Welcome to the programme. The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith has asked every bishop's conference in the world to prepare guidelines by May 2012 for dealing with cases of sexual abuse of minors by clergy in ways appropriate to specific situations in the different regions. In a circular letter published on Monday, the Congregation offers suggestions to facilitate the formulation of the guidelines and ensure consistency at the level of the Universal Church, while at the same time respecting the competence of bishops and major religious superiors. According to the letter, the guidelines must include priority support for victims, prevention programmes, seminary formation and ongoing formation of clergy, cooperation with civil authorities, and a careful and rigorous implementation of the most recent canonical legislation in this field. My colleague Emma McCarthy tells us more.
The circular letter is divided into three parts. The first part develops a set of general considerations for bishops' conferences around the world. The second addresses applicable canonical legislation in the field. And the third and final part lists a number of useful observations in formulating concrete guidelines. The history of the guidelines date back to May 2010, 1 year ago, when Pope Benedict XVI promulgated a revised version of the Motu Proprio Sacramentorum Sanctitatis Tutela on norms on the most serious crimes, including the sexual abuse of minors by members of the clergy. That revision of the Motu Proprio revised the Holy See legislation, but the fact remained that not every national bishops' conference had their own individual guidelines on protecting minors and dealing with cases of sexual abuse by clergy. Monday's letter is a way of making sure that, 1 year from now, by May 2012, this will no longer be the case. In fact, back in November 2010, as churches in Germany, Austria and Belgium one by one found themselves having to face the scourge of abuse and international media focus intensified, Cardinal William Leveda, prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, reporting to the College of Cardinals in a pre-consistory meeting, revealed the Congregation was working on additional guidance for bishops' conferences. He said this was in order to ensure what he termed as a coordinated and effective programme in responding to cases of abuse and bolstering the responsibility of bishops for the care of the faithful entrusted to them. He listed four key elements: the listening to and welcoming of victims and their families, collaboration with civil authorities, the need for effective efforts in the protection of children and young people within the church, and an attentive selection and formation of future priests and religious. All of which are contained in Monday's letter. Two further things are clear from the CDF letter. First, that the Vatican is fully aware of the need to address the problem promptly, effectively, and clearly. And secondly, that fundamental responsibility in dealing with and reporting cases of abuse to church and civil authorities lies with local bishops and local major religious superiors. And here perhaps lies the only real novelty of this letter. It's stating in no uncertain terms that the prescriptions of civil law regarding the reporting of such crimes to the designated authority should always be followed. For the rest, the guidelines in reality elaborate on the four points first mentioned by Pope Benedict XVI himself in his 2006 address to the Irish bishops on their ad limina visit, and again in his 2008 pastoral letter to the Catholics of Ireland regarding the crisis of sexual abuse within that church. In the note accompanying the CDF letter publication Monday, Holy See Press Office Director Father Federico Lombardi concludes that the letter itself represents a new and very important step in promoting awareness throughout the Universal Church of the need and urgency to effectively respond to the scourge of sexual abuse by members of the clergy. Only in this way can we renew full credibility in the witness and educational mission of the Church. I'm Emer McCarthy.
Commemorating Pope Benedict's visit to Britain, cooperating with local councils to help those worst hit by the recession, and calling on all Catholics to stop eating meat on Fridays. Those were amongst the priorities on the agenda of the Catholic bishops of England and Wales, who've just held their regular spring meeting in the northern city of Leeds. The meeting, which ended last Thursday, was focused on deepening and developing the vision that Pope Benedict offered during his four-day trip to England and Scotland last September. To find out more, I spoke to the president of the Bishops' Conference and Archbishop of Westminster, Vincent Nichols. Archbishop Vincent Nichols, you've just concluded your spring meeting of the Bishops' Conference there in the UK. High on the agenda, I believe, was the way you're going to be commemorating the anniversary of the papal visit, the visit that Pope Benedict made last September. Tell us a bit about that.
We've decided to hold a national commemoration in Westminster Cathedral on the anniversary on the 18th Sunday, the 18th of September. And all the bishops will come to that, and we'll meet afterwards, as you were, reconstructing and recalling the historic meeting we had with the Holy Father. But perhaps more importantly, the whole of the impetus we were given by the papal visit has continued to shape our reflection on our work. We looked very closely at some of the content of the message of the Holy Father, and we're building our future priorities around that content. We looked at the response of people to the papal visit and an emerging confidence and identity of Catholics, and we've taken a few steps in that direction as well. And we continue to look and explore the role of religion in public life, which was such a central part of the papal visit. So the papal visit continues to be the impetus for our work.
You're talking about finding practical ways to build on that. Can you give us any ideas in practical terms of how you can move ahead on the basis of what the Pope said and the way people reacted, as you say?
Well, one thing we're decided to do is to ask Catholics to focus again on the Friday penance as abstaining from meat. In 1984, in response to the responsibilities laid on the Bishops' Conference with the revision of canon law, we offered people quite a wide choice of acts of penance. Now, what we want to do is, without, as it were, withdrawing those, say, from next September, from the anniversary of the papal visit, we now expect Catholics together as a community in a very clear way to use abstaining from meat as the sign of their Friday penance, their Friday desire to keep in mind and to be one with Christ, who gave up his life on the cross for us. We're also reflecting on some of the key holy days, the Epiphany and the Ascension, and we're also going to make a particular effort to study the opportunities of our culture as part of our preparation for the forthcoming Synod of Bishops on the new evangelisation. And we're pleased that Archbishop Bernard Longley has been appointed by the Holy Father to be part of the Pontifical Council for the new evangelisation.
Let's look back a moment at that Fish on Friday, as it's often called, that initiative of Catholic witness, as you call it. How much support is there for this, do you think, amongst people in Britain today? Because it is going back to something that was quite popular in the past.
Well, there was a notice in a fish shop that was pointed out to us, a notice that said more fish is sold on Friday than any other day at all in this country. So there is still a cultural association of fish and Fridays. And I think it's still there within the Catholic identity. And that's what we want to offer. We want to offer our community the benefit of acquiring a habit in common. Because when we seek to acquire habits of penance, in this case, in common, then the lesson is more quickly and more strongly brought home, and we begin to get into a pattern of life, which means every Friday we give up, in this case, meat, in order to remember that Christ gave up his life for us on the cross.
Another issue high on the agenda during your meeting, I believe, was how to deepen social engagement in Britain today, a real new culture of social responsibility to people in need.
Well, that's correct. Clearly, this was something that was given impetus by the Holy Father and also by some of the comments of the Prime Minister when he said one of the aims of his coalition government was to foster a culture of greater social involvement. So what we've been doing since the visit and since last November is surveying how much, in fact, the Catholic community contributes in social action, both through its major charities, some of the religious orders charities, and right down to the myriad of small initiatives that take place in every parish where people reach out to those in need around them. And what we've tried to determine to do is to create a much closer network between all of that and to see if it can't be seen, be strengthened by association, and indeed be a focus of exchange of gifts and experience. And we're looking towards the Caritas model in order to try and develop that closer network, closer mutual cooperation, and closer identity. So we've got some hard work to do, but we will be using the Caritas network in order to test some of the models by which we can achieve what we want to achieve.
Now, these talks are taking place, or these ideas are taking place, if you like, in the context, as you mentioned, of David Cameron, the Prime Minister's big society. And there are sort of fears that perhaps, in a way, the church is being asked to take over where the government is now failing to deliver, isn't there?
Well, I think these are two distinct items of policy that are emerging. I think everybody acknowledges that Britain, like many other countries, is in a period of economic austerity. And indeed, in one of our conferences, we were given a very clear picture of spending forecasts for the next 10 years. And there is no doubt that available income is going down. And that applies to individuals, to families, to local authorities, and to central government. How that is handled is a very sensitive matter. And there we keep saying that the needs of the poorest, the needs of the most vulnerable, really have to be kept high on the agenda. On the other hand, and at the same time, there is a desire to generate a greater sense of mutual responsibility, and it's that part of the agenda that we were considering very closely. They come together in a desire that we expressed, a kind of resolution that we expressed, that we will try and be in greater touch with our local authorities, because the different parts of Great Britain vary very considerably in how economic cutbacks impact on people. And while the Catholic Church isn't hugely rich in resources, it's certainly rich in generous people. And there might be more to be done with greater cooperation between the local Catholic Church and a local authority in trying to make sure that those who are most vulnerable are not unduly and severely burdened by economic necessity. That is the fear that what will happen, and we have to speak up on behalf of those who are most vulnerable, but also see if there's some contribution we can make in practice as well.
One final issue on your agenda, I understand, was the teaching of religious education in schools and concerns about this new English baccalaureate that may not have religion as a test subject.
That's correct. And we passed a fairly strong statement, we've issued it today, which I hope will help with the ongoing discussions with the Secretary of State for Education. There is quite a broad upsurge of opinion. An early day motion in the House of Commons with well over 100 signatures on it, a public sign-up campaign with over 100,000 signatures on it, that religious education shouldn't be downgraded in this way. Clearly, the Secretary of State wants to give particular importance to subjects like history and geography, and that we fully understand. But we believe that in a time of increasing religious and cultural illiteracy, to downgrade RE seems particularly unwise. There is a need in our society for people to understand religious phenomena, and not only their own faith, but the faith of people around them, if we are going to build a harmonious society. So that is our appeal. We urge the government to reconsider its decision and now to include RE in the English baccalaureate.
Thanks there to Archbishop Vincent Nicholls of Westminster, President of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. And now Linda Bordoni is here to introduce her regular guest, Father Jim Brandt.
Dear brothers and sisters, the new series of catechesis, which we begin today, are devoted to prayer.
Over the past 2 years, Pope Benedict has been exploring the lives of saints. That series of talks concluded last month, and hence, during his general audience on May the 6th, the Pope announced the subject of a new topic, based on the request of the disciples to Christ. Lord, teach us to pray. Because we know that prayer cannot be taken for granted, the Pope said, we must learn to pray as if gaining back this art. Even those who are very advanced in the spiritual life, he continued, always feel the need to get to school to learn to pray to Jesus with authenticity. And picking up on that theme, Father Jim Brand brings us the first in his own series of meditations on prayer, with a reflection on how you and I have been spoken into being, and that every human person is a unique divine statement.
Hello everyone, it's Father Jim again. Thought I'd spend a few weeks on the question of prayer, and hope you'll find this comforting and helpful. I thought I'd quote a lovely poem. In the beginning of the war, the Second World War, George VI, in his Christmas broadcast in 1939, when things looked dim and dark, he quoted from this poem, the first six lines. I hadn't realised at the time that maybe the author of this poem, Minnie Louise Haskins, might have taught me. When I was five, in 1940, I used to be dragged every day screaming down some country lanes to a little nursery school run by two ladies. Miss Haskins looked like a benevolent German Hausfrau. She had a bun and sticking out teeth, and her sidekick used to play the piano. She had glasses on a string round her neck. In fact, between them, they looked a bit like Hinge and Bracket. But we used to have to sing All Things Bright and Beautiful. And do you know, even at the age of five, I said to myself, that's a Protestant hymn, and I wouldn't join in. Well, I've changed since then. But I didn't realise she was a poetess. Certainly didn't know her name was Minnie. We would have had a giggle, I'm sure, aged five, if she was known as Minnie. But this is the poem. It's called God Knows. I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, give me a light, that I may tread safely into the unknown. And he replied, go out into the darkness, and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light, and safer than a known way. So I went forth, and finding the hand of God, trod gladly into the night. And he led me towards the hills and the breaking of day in the lone east. So, heart, be still. What need our little life, our human life, to know if God hath comprehension? In all the dizzy strife of things both high and low, God hideth his intention. God knows. His will is best. The stretch of years which wind ahead, so dim to our imperfect vision, are clear to God. Our fears are premature. In him all time hath full provision. Then rest, until God moves to lift the veil from our impatient eyes. When, as the sweeter features of life's stern face we hail, fair beyond all surmise God's thought around his creatures, our mind shall fill. It's Minnie Louise Haskins, 1875 to 1957. For me, this is a most marvellous preparation for prayer, when we put our hand into the hand of God. One of the difficulties with prayer has been the impression that everyone should pray in the same way. In some ways, the Our Father isn't a prayer, it is a school of prayer. Our Lord said, say things like this. And so the Church has always prayed the Our Father in the monasteries, the Divine Office, in the Eucharist, trying to do what he told us to do, to learn how to pray. Now we have to remember that we're not angels, we're human beings. So there are all aspects of prayer which affect human beings. And we need to remember we're all unique human beings. So we mustn't put ourselves into straight jackets and be unnatural. For me, the essence of prayer isn't, "Listen, Lord, your servant is speaking," but, "Speak, Lord, and your servant is listening." And sometimes we tend to broadcast so much, we jam and censor out God who wishes to speak pillow talk in our ears. I remember in the army, we used to have signals training. And in those days, we had these wireless sets. And if you wanted to broadcast, you pressed a button, which stopped any broadcast coming in. You said your piece. And then when you finish, you say, "Over." You take your finger off the button, and that meant the other person had a chance to speak to you. Well, often in prayer, we've got our finger on our own button, and we're broadcasting. And we're frightened of going into silence and into darkness, in case we do hear God, in case God does get a word in edgeways. So that is why often silence is the beginning of prayer. And if we go out into the darkness and holding the hand of God, we'll see the stars coming out. Because when God speaks, he doesn't usually use a megaphone. He whispers sweet nothings in our ears, and this requires great silence. Another difficulty in prayer is that contemplative prayer seemed to be a speciality for superannuated nuns and monks, which you might attain when you're 90. I want to suggest that to be contemplative is natural. It's not something odd. I remember once I was in an infant school, and the children were watching chickens' eggs hatch, a little incubator. And the children's eyeballs were popping out of their head with amazement. So were mine. And there was a deep silence, ruined by the teacher, who came crashing in with big boots on, said, "Now, children, let's thank God for all these little chickens." Well, what did she think they were doing all the time? Already in prayer, but because she had ants in her pants and couldn't stand the silence, she felt she had to bring in God by the scruff of the neck. So children of five are naturally contemplative. The sad thing is we sometimes lose this because we feel we have to be entertaining. We have to do the talking. And it jams God. Another important thing about prayer, I think, is this. Between the Father and the Son, there is many things happening. The whole world couldn't contain the amazing mystery. First of all, there's something to do with giving and receiving. In eternity, whatever that means, it's beyond my comprehension, the Father has given everything to the Son, and so the Son has accepted everything. Now, if my own Father had been infinite and gave me everything, I'd probably have a terrible guilt complex. But within the Godhead, when the Son receives everything, he's given the Father the gift of being able to give. There's nothing more frustrating than wanting to give and nobody will receive. And within the Godhead, the giving and the receiving are of equal dignity and value. In our world, we tend to canonize the givers, sort of great, big, generous people whose names go up in lights. And we can patronize the receivers and make them feel guilty and in debt. But within the Trinity, the receiving and the giving are equal. So the Father specializes in giving, and the Son in receiving, and the Father says to the Son, "Thank you for allowing me to give." The Son's speciality is forgiveness. And when we give the Son permission to forgive, it made our Lord's days. He says, "Thanks, Jim. Thank you. You've made my day. You've allowed me to be me at my best." Now Mary was looked on in her nothingness. But by receiving everything from God, she gave the Father the gift of being able to give the Spirit. How pleased the Father must have been. So I want to suggest that prayer is not to make us feel small and insignificant. It is an extremely dignified thing to be able to stand in the presence of God and allow his voice to be heard. Now the whole of creation is a divine statement. Light, earth, chemicals, stars, plants, trees, and Jim. You and I have been spoken into being. God says, Jim. And therefore, every human person is a unique, divine statement. Mary. Bill. The fact that I exist is God saying something. And therefore each one of us is a divine prayer. Our being is a divine statement. And when we take possession and ownership of the wonder of our being, that is our primary response. And God must be so grateful that we accept the reality of our being. Some people have great pain over this. They think, oh my gosh, my face. I should have gone to the smelters. 2 out of 10 for my face. 3 out of 10 for my personality. 1 out of 10 for my history. And God spends a lot of time trying to reassure us that each one of us is an original, totally irreplaceable, divine work of art. So each of us is a living prayer from God. And when we listen to ourselves, we're listening to the one who sent us. When we listen to each other, we're listening to the one who sent us. If we reject each other, we are rejecting the one who has sent us. And so I like to think that we are an echo chamber where God wants to hear himself, a faithful echo chamber. We don't want to jam and block God's conversation. We're really saying, here I am, Lord. When he says, Jim, here I am. And so next week, I'll carry on, but I did want to insist that contemplative prayer is normal. It is allowing God to hear himself within us. It requires self-emptying of bits and pieces. Amen.
That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow. So join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.